Usually, like when you talk about the foundation of the global financial system, you picture, I don't know, giant bank vaults or, maybe some gold bars or guys in very expensive suits just yelling on a trading floor.
Right, like an 80s movie.
Exactly. You assume it's this incredibly solid, perfectly predictable bedrock. But, well, when you actually dig into the mechanics of U.S. government debt, and then you look at the wild Frankenstein-style mortgage products built right on top of it, things get intensely complicated.
Oh, it really is a rabbit hole. I mean, we are starting today with the safest, most, boring, plain vanilla bonds on the planet. But by the end of this discussion, we are going to be slicing and dicing these completely invisible mortgage risks into dozens of different buckets just to appease Wall Street.
Yeah. And to figure out how this plumbing actually works, we were looking through a massive stack of materials today. We've pulled apart Series 7 study guides, historical bond market data from the Treasury Department, rule books, and a bunch of our own notes on how these structured products actually behave in the real world.
Which is key, yeah.
Right. So our mission is to completely deconstruct this entire corner of the market for anyone prepping for their Series 7 exam. I mean,
Okay.
we aren't just memorizing rules today. We are going to figure out why these rules exist in the first place.
Yeah, because if you understand the underlying logic, when the exam tries to trap you, and it absolutely will try to trap you, you'll see it coming a mile away.
Oh, for sure.
Because look, understanding the mechanics is the only way to actually retain this information under exam conditions. Memorization fails when you are stressed, comprehension doesn't.
Exactly the goal. Oh, and before we jump into the deep end, this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 7 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. It's a fantastic resource if you're grinding through this material. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
Okay, so back to the plumbing.
Let's do it.
To make sure these abstract concepts actually stick in our brains, we are bringing in three hypothetical investors today. Like, we're gonna follow them through different scenarios so this feels less like a textbook and more like, I don't know, an actual story.
I love that. Establishing a cast of characters is it's a great way to map out risk tolerance, which is, as you know, a huge part of the exam. So who do we have?
Okay, first we have Steady Steve.
Yeah.
Steve hates risk. Like, he is terrified of losing money. He just wants safe, predictable income, but he constantly gets tangled up in tax rules and administrative paperwork.
Okay, Steady Steve, got it. Then we have Discount Dan. Dan loves a deal. He hates getting checks in the mail. He doesn't want to manage ongoing payments. He just wants to buy something cheap right now, put it in a drawer, and get a massive lump sum payoff a decade later.
Ah, classic zero coupon investor. That's Dan. And the third.
Frantic Fiona. Fiona is, well, she's constantly panicking. She is watching interest rates like a hawk. She is terrified of uncertainty, and she obsesses over exactly when, like to the day, she is getting her money back.
Oh, she's going to hate the mortgage section.
She is going to be miserable.
Oh,
So,
yeah.
keeping Steady Steve, Discount Dan, and Frantic Fiona in our heads, let's unpack the baseline. Before we get into the weird mortgage derivatives, we have to start with the absolute bedrock, which is U.S. Treasuries.
Right, because every other bond in the world is essentially priced relative to these instruments. And the reason they are, the baseline is pretty simple. They carry zero default risk,
Okay.
or as the exam will phrase it, zero credit risk. They are backed by the full faith and credit of the US government.
Meaning, like, for exam purposes, the chance of the government just deciding not to pay you back is zero because they can always just, print more money to pay off their debt.
Exactly. That is the assumption the entire global market operates on. They are the absolute highest credit quality available.
Right.
Now, administratively, you need to know they are issued in book entry form.
Wait, book entry. So no paper.
No paper. There are no paper certificates anymore. You don't get like a beautifully engraved piece of paper with a bald eagle on it to lock in a safe. It's all just electronic records. Furthermore, they trade over the counter or OTC.
Wait, let's define that quickly because OTC can sound, I don't know, kind of shady like penny
Yeah,
stocks.
sure, yeah.
But for treasuries, it just means they do not trade on a centralized exchange like the New York Stock Exchange.
Right, exactly right. It is a decentralized network of banks and dealers trading electronically. That's a crucial distinction. The largest, most liquid market in the world is actually OTC. But here's the first major hurdle for our friend Steady Steve. He loves the idea of zero default risk, so he buys a treasury. He assumes, because it is a government bond, that it is completely tax-free.
Oh boy. Okay, this is where we need to sound the alarm. Like, listener, hear me now. This is a classic exam trap. Do not fall for the tax trap.
No.
Treasuries are safe, yes, but they're not entirely tax-free. They are exempt from state and local taxes, but they are absolutely subject to federal income tax.
Yeah, and the historical reason for this is actually pretty fascinating. It comes down to constitutional friction.
Oh, really?
Yeah, early in U.S. history, the Supreme Court ruled that state governments cannot tax the federal government's functions, and, vice versa. The federal government generally shouldn't tax state functions. It's like a mutual non-interference pact.
Oh, I had no idea that was why.
Yeah, so if Steve buys a U.S. Treasury, his local mayor and his state governor, they cannot touch that interest. But the IRS, which is federal, they absolutely will collect federal tax on it.
Okay, so we have this baseline. Zero default risk, state tax-free, federal taxable. Let's meet the big three treasury securities. I want to start with Discount Dan's absolute favorite, the T-bill, treasury bills.
T-bills, yeah, they are the shortest maturity treasury security. They run anywhere from 4 months up to 52 weeks, so 1 year max. And they function entirely as zero coupon instruments.
Okay, so let me stop and ask the listener a direct question. Think about Discount Dan for a second. He buys this T-bill. How much semi-annual interest does he get in the mail?
Right, think about it.
None. Zero. His mailbox is completely empty. Why? Because it's zero coupon bond. There are no semi-annual payments.
And the exam loves to test that specific fact. T-bills do not pay semi-annual interest.
Right.
Instead, they are sold at a discount to par. So, like, Dan buys the T-bill for, let's say, $980. He holds it for 26 weeks. When it matures, the government simply hands him $1,000.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that $20 difference is his return. It is quoted on a discount yield basis.
Dan loves that. You know, pay less up front, get face value later. Short, sweet liquid, no mail docs anxiety at all. But what if Steady Steve wants actual income? Like, he needs a check to pay his property taxes every 6 months.
Oh, Steve needs to step slightly further out on the timeline and buy a T-note, a treasury note.
Okay.
These are intermediate term. They mature in 2, 3, 5, 7, or 10 years. And unlike T-bills, T-notes actually do pay a fixed coupon semi-annually.
And the 10-year T-note, I mean, that's basically the center of the financial universe, isn't it?
It really is. It is the anchor for global finance. When you hear about, like, mortgage rates going up on the news or corporate borrowing becoming more expensive, those rates are typically quoted as a spread above the yield on the 10-year note.
Wow.
Yeah, it is the most widely watched benchmark for long-term interest rates in the entire world.
All right, so T-bills are under a year, zero coupon. T-notes are 2 to 10 years, semi-annual coupons. What about the really long stuff, like the stuff you buy and just forget about for decades?
Those are T-bonds, treasury bonds. These are for the long haul, 20 and 30 year maturities. They also pay semi-annual coupons, just like T-notes.
Right.
But here is the critical concept the exam wants you to grasp, and it has to do with time. Because T-bonds have the longest maturity, they have the absolute highest interest rate risk.
Okay, my brain always gets tangled here. Why does a longer time mean higher risk? Because like, if I lock in a rate for 30 years, I feel safe. I know what I'm getting.
Well, you know the income you are getting, but the market value of your bond, its actual price, if you tried to sell it tomorrow, that is what carries the risk. This is the concept of duration. The longer you are locked into a fixed rate, the more sensitive your bond's physical price is to changes in the overall market.
Okay, let me try an analogy here to see if I've got this. It's like a seesaw, right?
Okay.
So the pivot point in the middle is the current interest rate. And the length of the seesaw board is the time to maturity.
That's a perfect way to visualize it.
So a 4 week T-bill is like sitting right next to the pivot point.
Yeah.
If interest rates bounce up and down, your seat barely moves, you aren't locked in long enough to care.
Right.
But a 30-year T-bond is like sitting at the very, very end of a 30-foot seesaw.
Huh.
If the market interest rate shifts even a tiny bit, you are getting violently thrown up into the air or slammed into the ground.
Because if you hold a 30-year T-bond paying, let's say, 3%, and suddenly inflation spikes and brand new bonds are paying 6%, nobody wants to buy your 3% bond.
Oh, right. Why would they?
Exactly. The only way you can sell it to someone is by drastically dropping your price. So the rule to memorize for the test, longest maturity equals greatest price of volatility. T-bonds swing wildly in price compared to short-term T-bills.
That makes total sense. Okay, let's talk about how these things actually look on a trading screen, because I know there is a massive trap here.
Oh, yeah.
If I'm a broker and I'm looking at T-notes and T-bonds, how are they priced? Because my instinct is that if I see a T-note quoted at 99-16, that just means $99.16.
And that instinct will cause you to fail the question.
Ouch.
Yeah, this is the 30 seconds quotation trap. T-notes and T-bonds are quoted as a percentage of par, but the fractions are in 30 seconds, not in standard base 10 decimals.
30 seconds. Why on earth would they do that?
It
That seems aggressively confusing on purpose.
really does, but it ours a historical legacy from like hundreds of years ago. Early American financial markets were heavily influenced by Spanish currency. You know the famous pieces of eight.
Oh, like pirate treasure.
Basically, yeah. Spanish dollars could be physically cut into eight pieces or bits. That's where the phrase 2 bits for a quarter comes from.
Fine.
So the New York Stock Exchange and the bond markets kept dividing fractions further down to 16ths and then 30 seconds as a way of quoting spreads.
Yeah.
Now, the stock market eventually modernized to decimals back in 2001, but the US Treasury market stubbornly kept the 30-second system.
That is wild. Okay, so how do I actually read 99-16 on the exam? I can't just ignore the dash.
No, you have to isolate the number after the dash and treat it as a fraction over 32. So the 16 means 16 over 32.
Okay, doing the mental math. 16 divided by 32 is 1/2, 0.50.
Correct. So a quote of 99-16 actually translates to 99.50% of par.
Let me try a harder one.
Okay.
Say the exam shows me a quote of 101-08.
Okay.
So my brain immediately reads that as $101.08, but you're
Yeah.
saying that's wrong.
Very wrong.
So I take the 08.8 divided by 32, that simplifies to 1 over 4, which is 0.25.
Right.
So the actual decimal price is 101.25% of par.
Spot on. You must convert that trailing number into a fraction over 32 and then convert that to a decimal before you try to calculate the dollar value of the bond. If you just read it as dollars and cents, you will miss the question every single time.
Okay, 30 seconds. Got it. All right, so we've established the baseline. Regular treasuries, we understand the tax rules, the seesaw of duration, and the pirate coin math of 30 seconds. But what happens when our investors need something a little more specialized?
What do you mean?
Well, let's say Steady Steve is suddenly terrified of inflation. He's looking at his semi-annual coupon from his regular T-note, and he's worried that in 5 years, that fixed cash payment is going to be completely worthless if the cost of groceries doubles.
Right.
Or what if Discount Dan wants a guaranteed 10-year payout for his kid's college and he really doesn't want to deal with reinvesting coupons? How does the Treasury solve those specific problems?
Well, the Treasury modifies the baseline to solve both of those issues. Let's start with Steve's inflation anxiety. If an investor's primary fear is purchasing power risk, which is just the risk that inflation eats their returns, the Treasury offers TIPS.
Pipes.
Yes. Treasury inflation protected securities. These come in 5, 10, and 30-year maturities.
But how does the mechanism actually work? Because a coupon rate itself doesn't just float around randomly, right?
No, the coupon rate on TIPS is completely fixed.
Yep.
If you buy a TIPS with a 2% coupon, that rate never ever changes for the entire life of the bond. What does adjust is the principal, the actual par value of the bond itself. The Treasury links that principal to the CPIU, the Consumer Price Index for all urban consumers.
So let me pause you there. Listener, think about this. If inflation goes up by 3%, Steve's coupon rate stays exactly at 2%. But that 2% is now being multiplied against a bigger principal. So, like, let's walk through the math on that.
Sure. If you start with $1,000 TIPS and inflation hits 3%, the principal is adjusted upward to $1,030. Now, when the Treasury calculates your semi-annual interest payment, they take your fixed 2% rate, but they apply it to the new $1,030 balance instead of the original $1,000.
Oh. So the actual dollar amount of Steve's check gets bigger, even though the interest rate didn't change at all. That's a brilliant way to protect purchasing power.
It really is.
But wait, what if we hit a weird economic period like 2008 and we get deflation? The cost of goods actually drops. Does Steve's principal shrink?
Yes, it works both ways. If there is deflation, the principal adjusts downward. And because the principal is smaller, those semi-annual interest checks will also shrink.
But I feel like I read about a floor. Like a safety net, so you don't lose your initial investment.
There is a deflation floor, but this is a very, very common point of confusion.
Okay.
The deflation floor only applies at maturity. It dictates that when the bond finally matures, the investor receives the greater of the inflation-adjusted principal or the original par value. It guarantees you will get at least your original $1,000 back at the very end.
Let me make sure I have this exactly right because it feels like a trick. It protects the final payout, but it does not protect the semi-annual interest payments along the way.
Correct.
So if deflation happens in year two, My principal drops to $980, and my next interest check is calculated on $980.
Yeah.
The floor doesn't step in and save my interest payments from dropping.
That is precisely how it works. The floor only catches you at the finish line.
Wow. Okay. Good to know. So let's pivot back to Discount Dan. He doesn't care about inflation right now. He hates reinvestment risk. He wants to put a lump sum away for his kids' college in exactly 10 years.
Okay.
If he buys a normal 10-year T-note, he's going to get a coupon payment every 6 months. And he hates that because he doesn't want the hassle of taking that cash and trying to reinvest it in the market, especially if interest rates have tanked and he can only find terrible yields. He just wants to lock in a single yield today for a specific date in the future.
Right. For Dan, the Treasury created strips.
Okay.
Separate trading of registered interest and principal of securities.
I absolutely love the visual of this. Tell me if I'm picturing this right.
Go for it.
Imagine a physical coupon book for a 10-year Treasury note. It has 20 little payment slips attached to it for the semi-annual interest and one final slip at the very back for the principal. The strips program is essentially a financial institution violently ripping each slip out of the book, throwing away the binding and selling all 21 slips individually as completely separate, zero coupon securities.
I mean, that is mechanically exactly what stripping a bond means. Each individual interest payment and the final principal payment, they get their own unique identifier, their own CUSIP number.
Wait, a CUSIP? That's basically just a barcode or like a social security number for a financial asset, right?
Yes, a 9-character alphanumeric code that uniquely identifies a specific U.S. or Canadian security. So each ripped out slip gets its own barcode and trades independently on the open market.
That's crazy.
Yeah, so Dan can go in and buy just the principal strip at a deep discount, throw it in a drawer, pay no attention to it for 10 years, and then collect the face value.
And because there are no coupons arriving in the mail along the way, there's absolutely zero reinvestment risk.
None.
Dan doesn't have to worry about what market interest rates are doing in year five, because he isn't receiving any cash in year five to reinvest anyway. He knows the exact dollar amount he's getting on the exact date he needs it.
It is perfectly suited for funding a known future liability, like, you know, college tuition or a specific retirement date. But the exam is going to test you on the backing of these products.
What do you mean?
Strips are a direct U.S. Treasury program, which means they are backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
Why does that distinction matter so much? Are there other ways to buy these before the government did it?
There were, yeah. Before the strips program officially started in 1985, Wall Street broker-dealers used to do this themselves.
Oh, okay.
A firm would buy regular treasuries, lock them in a bank trust, and then sell their own proprietary receipts based on the stripped payments. You might see names on the exam like Tiggers from Merrill Lynch or Katz from Salomon Brothers.
Oh, right. Tiggers, Treasury Investment Growth Receipts, and Katz, Certificates of Accrual on Treasury Securities. Wall Street really loves a feline acronym.
They really do. But here is the critical difference. Tiggers and Katz are not direct obligations of the U.S. government. They are broker-dealer trust products, so they carry a layer of counterparty risk. If the trust itself has administrative issues or the broker-dealer goes bankrupt, you might actually have a problem.
Yikes.
Right. So the Treasury eventually looked at this massive, lucrative market the broker-dealers had created and said, we can do this ourselves better and safer. So they created strips, which eliminated the middleman. Strips have no counterparty risk.
Got it. Okay. Strips equals direct government backing. Tiggers and Katz equals trust backing.
Exactly.
Okay, time for a pattern interrupt. Mm-hmm. Seriously, listener, stop what you are doing. If you are walking the dog, stop walking. If you are doing dishes, put the sponge down. Listen to me right now. If you remember one thing from this entire section on tips and strips, remember the ghost, the phantom income menace.
Oh, yeah. This is arguably one of the most highly tested tax concepts in this entire unit. Both tips and strips create phantom income.
Let's explain what that means, because frankly, it sounds incredibly unfair to the investor.
It comes down to IRS accrual accounting rules. With tips, your principal is adjusting upward with inflation every year, right?
Right.
With strips, the value of your deep discount bond is accreting, meaning it is mathematically growing closer to its final par value every year. In both cases, your wealth is increasing on paper, and the IRS demands to tax that gain every single year as ordinary income.
Wait. Even though I haven't received a dime of that cash yet.
Correct.
I don't actually get the tips as principal adjustment until the bond matures. I don't get the strips payoff until year 10. My pockets are entirely empty right now. But the IRS expects a check this year for a theoretical gain.
Yes. Taxable income with no corresponding cash flow. That is the exact definition of phantom income. The IRS doesn't care that you haven't received the cash. They care that the asset's value legally accrued to you.
That's brutal.
It is. And because of this, it forces a major suitability question on the exam. Where should a financial advisor place these assets? What is the most suitable account for tips or strips?
Okay, let me think. It has to be a tax-deferred account, right? Like an IRA or a 401k.
Yes.
Because if you put them in an IRA, you completely shield that annual phantom income from current taxation.
Yeah.
The IRS can't touch it until you actually withdraw the cash in retirement, at which point you finally, you know, have the money to pay the tax bill.
That is the exact takeaway the exam wants. Because they generate phantom income, tips and strips belong in tax-advantaged accounts. If you put them in a standard taxable brokerage account, the investor is going to have to pull cash from somewhere else entirely every April just to pay the taxes on money they haven't even received.
Man, Steady Steve would hate that. Okay, so we've covered the direct treasury obligations. But let's say Steve is looking at his portfolio and he's just not thrilled with the low yield on treasuries. They are too safe, so they pay too little. He wants slightly higher income, but he doesn't want to jump into the wild west of corporate junk bonds.
So we step slightly out on the risk spectrum. We move away from the direct treasury, and we enter the world of agency securities.
Agencies, okay.
This is where we start pooling residential mortgages and student loans. And we need to meet the cast of characters here, because the exam is going to ask you to tell them apart. It's kind of a who's who of government-adjacent entities. Let's start with the golden child, Ginnie Mae.
Ginnie Mae, or GNMA, the Government National Mortgage Association. Why is she the golden child?
Because Ginnie Mae is a wholly owned government agency operating within the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Because it is an actual piece of the federal government, its securities are the only mortgage-backed securities backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
Let me emphasize that. The only one.
Yes. Ginnie Mae securities have the exact same explicit guarantee as a U.S. Treasury bond. They take pools of government-insured mortgages, specifically VA loans for veterans and FHA loans, and they pass the monthly payments through to investors.
But here's a massive exam trap that catches people.
Yeah.
Does Ginnie Mae actually originate these mortgages? Like, are there Ginnie Mae loan officers sitting across a desk from a home buyer stamping an approval form?
No, never. Ginnie Mae does not originate or purchase mortgages. They don't have bank branches. They simply guarantee the timely payment of principal and interest on securities that are issued by approved private lenders, like your local bank.
Oh.
They are a guarantor, not an originator. They just wrap the pool of loans in their golden government-backed force field.
Okay, so Ginny is the golden child with the explicit guarantee. What about the siblings, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac?
Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac are GSEs, government-sponsored enterprises.
Right.
They are publicly traded, privately owned corporations, although they've been under heavy federal conservatorship since the 2008 financial crisis. They buy conventional mortgages from banks, package them up, and sell them to investors.
And the most important distinction here is the guarantee, right?
Right, because they are GSEs and not actual government agencies like Ginny. Their securities carry no explicit full faith and credit guarantee. Legally speaking, the U.S. government does not have to step in if Fannie or Freddie fails. They only have an implied or moral backing. The market assumes the government wouldn't let them fail, but it is not a legal guarantee.
So, listener, if the exam asks, which agency security is backed by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government? And the choices are Fannie, Freddie, Sally, and Ginny. The answer is Ginny. Every time.
Every time. Oh, and a quick vocab note on Freddie Mac. They like to brand things differently. They call their pass-through products participation certificates or PCs. If you see PC on the test, think Freddie Mac.
Okay, PC is Freddie Mac. So we have Ginny with full explicit backing, Fannie and Freddie with implied moral backing, and then we have the outcast of the family, Sally Mae.
Sally Mae. Yeah, they deal in student loans, not mortgages. And they underwent a massive transition a while back.
Right, they went fully private.
They did. To originate more loans outside of government balance sheet constraints, they fully privatized, which means they have zero government backing. None.
None at all.
It's not explicit, not implied. They issue asset-backed securities backed by private student loans, and investors carry the full credit risk of that private corporation.
So from safest to riskiest, it's Ginny, then Fannie and Freddie, then Sally.
Exactly.
Okay, think about this for a second. We just spent a lot of time establishing that U.S. treasuries are exempt from state and local taxes.
Yeah.
Do we think these agency securities, Ginnie, Fannie, Freddie, do they get that same special state tax exemption?
It is a massive exam trap to assume they do.
Okay.
Agency securities are taxed at all levels, federal, state, and local.
Why? Why do they lose the exemption?
Because they are not direct obligations of the U.S. Treasury used to fund the government's basic operations. They are separate entities funding specific sectors like housing. The states are fully within their rights to tax that income. So if Steady Steve buys a Ginnie Mae pass-through, he might have zero default risk, but he is paying taxes to everybody.
Oh, man, Steve's going to be so annoyed. Okay, so we've established who issues these things. But how do these mortgage pools actually behave mechanically?
It's different.
Because they don't act like normal bonds. Normal bonds pay interest twice a year and give your principal back in one big lump sum on a fixed maturity date. Mortgages do not do that. And this brings us to frantic Fiona, who hates uncertainty.
Let's talk about pass-through MBS mechanics. When you buy a mortgage-backed security, you aren't buying one house's mortgage. You are buying a pro rata share in a massive pool of hundreds or thousands of home loans.
Right.
When homeowners make their monthly mortgage payments, that cash is collected by a servicer. The servicer takes a tiny slice off the top to pay for the administrative hassle and the agency guarantee, and the rest of the cash is just passed through to the investors.
So two big differences pop up immediately. First, they pay monthly, not semi-annually, because homeowners pay their mortgages monthly.
Right.
Second, the yield the investor actually receives, the pass-through rate, is always slightly lower than the actual interest rate the homeowners are paying.
Yeah. If the pool of mortgages averages a 6.5% interest rate, the pass-through rate that Fiona receives might only be 6.0%. That 0.5% difference is the friction of the machine. It goes to pay the servicing and guarantee fees.
But here's why Fiona is absolutely frantic. With a treasury bond, you know the exact date it matures. With a mortgage, well, homeowners have this incredibly annoying habit of paying off their loans early.
They do.
They sell the house and move, or they hit the lottery and pay it off, or most commonly, they refinance.
This creates what is known as prepayment risk, and it is the defining central characteristic of all mortgage-backed securities. It's a timing risk.
Right.
The cash flow is unpredictable. You just don't know exactly when your principal is going to return to you.
And prepayment risk is actually a two-headed monster. It hurts you in both directions, depending on what the broader economy and interest rates are doing.
Exactly.
Let's look at the first head of the monster, contraction risk. This happens when interest rates fall. Let's use a real-world example, like 2020 and 2021. Rates plummeted.
Right. Think about human behavior. When mortgage rates drop to 2.5% or 3%, what does every homeowner in America do?
They refinance.
They rush to their local bank to refinance their mortgages at the new lower rate. But to do that, they have to legally pay off their old mortgage entirely.
Which means suddenly, a giant, unexpected wave of principal cash comes splashing out of the MBS pool and lands right in Fiona's lap.
Yep. The life of the security contracts. It physically shortens because everyone is paying it off so fast. Fiona is getting her money back way too early.
And why is she furious about this? Because interest rates have just fallen across the whole economy. She now has to take this big, unexpected pile of cash and reinvest it in a market that is only offering terrible, low yields.
It's the ultimate worst-case scenario for an income investor. You had a high-yielding asset, the homeowners ripped it away from you by refinancing, and now you're stuck buying low-yielding garbage. That's contraction risk.
Okay, now let's look at the second head of the monster, extension risk. This happens when interest rates rise. Think about, 2023 and 2024. Mortgage rates shot up to 7% or 8%.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, so rates are soaring. Homeowners look at their current 3% mortgages they locked in during 2020 and say, I am never, ever moving. I will be buried in the backyard of this house before I give up this 3% rate.
I know I said that.
Right. So prepayments grind to an absolute halt. Nobody is refinancing. Nobody is moving.
Which means the life of the security extends. Fiona is getting her principal back much, much slower than she originally expected.
And she's mad about this too. Because market rates are currently high, maybe she could get 6% on a brand new bond. But her money is trapped in this old mortgage pool, slowly dripping out at 3%. She's getting her money too late to take advantage of the new, higher rates.
So whether rates rise or fall, the timing of the cash flows works against the investor. That's why mortgage-backed securities simply cannot have a fixed maturity date. You can't put a hard date on human behavior.
Right.
Instead, they use a metric called weighted average life, or WALL, to estimate when the principal will likely be returned based on current prepayment models.
WALL, instead of maturity date. That's a great exam distinction. But Fiona is having a total meltdown. She cannot handle this prepayment uncertainty. She wants out of the mortgage market.
She's done.
Yeah. So Wall Street, being Wall Street, looks at this problem and says, what if we invent a machine that mathematically slices this risk up so we can sell the safe, predictable parts to Fiona and sell the insanely chaotic, risky parts to some hedge fund?
And that machine is the collateralized mortgage obligation, the CMO.
This is where we get into the really structured stuff. First rule of CMOs, and the exam will test this conceptually. CMOs do not eliminate prepayment risk.
Important.
They only redistribute it. The total amount of risk in the underlying mortgage pool is exactly the same. It's just being rearranged.
I like to use the Tower of Cups analogy for this. A CMO takes the chaotic, unpredictable river of mortgage cash flows, you know, the monthly payments, the sudden refinances, and directs that river into a structure of stacked cups, which we call tranches.
Let's build the tower. The top cup, the first one to catch the water, is the Pakey tranche, the planned amortization class. This is the safest, most predictable cup in the whole structure.
The pancake tranche has a specific planned schedule. Think of it as a cup with a special valve. It has what we call a collar or a prepayment band. As long as actual homeowner prepayments stay within that expected band, the Packy investor receives their principal exactly on schedule.
Okay.
It provides dual-sided protection. It protects against both contraction risk and extension risk.
So Fiona buys the Pack tranche. She finally has the certainty she craves. But in finance, there is no free lunch.
Oh.
If you have the lowest risk.
You get the lowest yield. The Pack tranche pays the least because it is the safest.
Okay, so the Pack cap is full. It's doing its job.
Yeah.
Any overflow cash from the mortgages drips down into the next cup in the tower, the TAC tranche, targeted amortization class.
TAC is a step down in safety. It uses a single target prepayment speed, not a protective band. So it only provides single-sided protection.
Meaning?
It protects against contraction risk, getting your money too early from a refinance boom, but it offers zero protection against extension risk if everyone stops moving.
Ah, and because it has more risk than the PAC, it offers a slightly higher yield. Okay. But mortgages are wild. What happens if homeowners refinance like crazy and there's a massive, violent flood of cash pouring into the top of the tower? The pack fills up, the tack fills up. Where does all that chaotic overflow go?
It goes into the bottom bucket, the companion or support tranche.
This is the trash can at the bottom of the structure that catches all the chaos.
Essentially, yes. Every CMO that has a pack or a tack must have a companion tranche to make the math work. Its entire job is to absorb the variability to protect the upper tranches.
So it takes the hit.
Yeah. When prepayments are fast, the companion takes all the excess principal. When prepayments are slow, the companion gets starved of cash entirely so the pack can stay on schedule.
So the companion tranche has the most volatile average life and bears the absolute most prepayment risk of anything in the structure.
Which means it also offers the highest yield. It compensates the hedge fund or institutional investor for taking on all the chaos that Fiona didn't want.
Okay, exam trap alert. If the exam asks which tranche has the most prepayment risk, it's the companion. If they ask which has the least, it's the PASCIXT. PASCIXT equals lowest risk, lowest yield. Companion equals highest risk, highest yield.
Very testable. Now, there is one more tranche we should mention hiding at the very bottom. The Z tranche, or accrual tranche.
The Z tranche is standing at the very back of the line.
Way back.
It gets absolutely zero cash, no principal, no interest, until every single other tranche in the entire CMO tower is entirely paid off. It's essentially a zero coupon bond built into a CMO. It has the longest life of all the tranches.
Right. So that's the CMO structure. It takes mortgage collateral and it redistributes timing risk, prepayment risk. But what if Wall Street wants to do this with other types of debt? What if they want to build a tower out of corporate bonds, auto loans, and credit card debt?
Then we are building a CDO, a collateralized debt obligation.
Exactly.
The exam is absolutely going to ask you to compare a CMO and a CDO side by side because they sound similar but solve very different problems.
Let's break down the differences. First, the underlying collateral. A CMO is backed only by residential or commercial mortgages. A CDO is backed by a diverse pool of debt. It could be corporate bonds, bank loans, auto loans, really any income-producing asset.
Second major difference is the specific risk being redistributed.
Oh.
CMOs slice up prepayment risk, which is a timing issue. CDOs slice up credit risk or default risk.
Right.
CDO investors aren't overly worried about when they get paid. They're terrified about if they get paid at all, because corporate bonds and credit cards default much more often than government-backed mortgages.
Exactly. So the CDO tower is built differently. The tranches are based on claim priority when things go wrong and the underlying loans start defaulting. At the top, you have the senior tranche.
Okay.
It gets paid first from the cash flow. It's the safest. It usually manages to secure an AAA rating from the agencies, and it pays the lowest yield.
In the middle is the mezzanine tranche, moderate risk, moderate yield.
Yeah.
And at the very bottom is the equity tranche. And here is a massive exam trap that we have to call out right now.
It's a linguistic trap.
Yeah. When you hear the word equity, you usually think of ownership, right? Mm-hmm. Like owning a stock. You think of upside potential. But in a CDO, the equity tranche does not mean safe ownership or unlimited upside.
Not at all. If the CDO tower is a physical building, the equity tranche is the basement. And it is the absolute first room to flood when defaults happen.
Great visual.
It absorbs credit losses first. Mm. It is the riskiest, often unrated, highest yielding tranche at the very bottom of the structure. Do not let the word equity trick you into thinking it's safe. It is just the shock absorber for the senior tranches.
Senior gets paid first. Equity takes the losses first.
Got it.
Okay. So we've bought all these crazy instruments. We've got our T-bonds, our Ginnie Mae's, our PEG tranches. Now we actually have to trade them in the secondary market. This brings us to the administrative glue of the entire bond market, accrued interest.
This is the practical math of bond trading. When you buy a bond from another investor between coupon payment dates, you don't just pay the quoted market price of the bond. You also have to mathematically compensate the seller for the interest they earned while they held the bond but haven't received yet.
Let me explain why this exists, because honestly, it confused me for a long time.
Go for it.
The Treasury or the corporation paying the bond doesn't track exactly who owned the bond on every single day of the month. They don't cut tiny little checks to five different people who traded the bond. On the actual payment date, they just look at whoever holds the bond that day, and they send that person the entire six-month check.
Exactly. So if you buy a bond from me 2 months before the payment date, I held it for 4 months. I earned 4 months of interest. But you're going to get the full six-month check. That isn't fair.
So to fix it, on settlement day, the buyer pays the seller the market price of the bond, plus accrued interest up to, but not including, the settlement date. Then, on the next payment date, the buyer gets the full coupon.
It's an administrative reimbursement. But how we count the days to calculate that reimbursement is where the exam gets technical.
Hmm.
There is a divide in the day count conventions used by the financial industry.
Let's draw the line. On one side, we have U.S. Treasury notes and Treasury bonds. They are the exception to the rule. They use an actual day count basis.
Right, right.
You literally pull out a calendar, count the actual number of days elapsed in the specific month, whether it's 28, 30, or 31, and divide by the actual number of days in the coupon period. The federal government has the computational power to be precise.
But literally everything else in this unit, securities, CMOs, corporate bonds, municipal bonds, they all use a simplified system called 3360.
Why 3360?
Mm-hmm.
It means you pretend every single month has exactly 30 days and every year has exactly 360 days. That is mathematically inaccurate. Why do they do that?
You have to think about history. This convention was established in the pre-computer era. Imagine being a bank clerk in the 1920s with a green visor trying to calculate accrued interest by hand for millions of municipal and corporate bonds.
Well, that sounds awful.
Trying to remember if it was a leap year or if the month had 31 days would have caused endless administrative errors. The 3360 method was a mathematical shortcut invented to make human calculation feasible, and the convention simply stuck even after computers took over.
I love that.
Yeah.
So Ginnie Mae, 3360, Fannie Mae, 3360, a CMO PAC tranche, 3360, a corporate bond, 3360. Only direct treasury notes and bonds use actual.
Correct. But let me throw one final wrench in the gears. We mentioned T-bills earlier. Discount Dan's favorite.
Oh.
If Dan buys a T-bill from another investor in the secondary market, how much accrued interest does he pay the seller at settlement?
Okay, let me think about it for a second. Based on what we established earlier, he's buying T-bill. You might try to calculate actual days, but wait. T-bills are zero coupon discount instruments.
Exactly. There is no stated interest rate, there are no semi-annual coupons, and therefore there is absolutely nothing to accrue. They simply trade at a fluctuating discount to par.
So if a question asks about accrued interest on a T-bill, the answer is always zero. Don't even try to do the math.
Zero accrued interest.
Incredible. We have covered so much ground today. From the safest, most pristine treasuries to the wildest, most chaotic CMO tranches. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of the top five most testable facts from this entire deep dive to lock it in.
Let's do it. Number one, day count conventions. Treasuries use actual. Everything else, agencies, CMOs, corporates uses 3360, and T-bills have zero accrued interest.
Perfect. Number two, the agency guarantee split. Ginnie Mae is the only one with the explicit full faith and credit backing of the U.S. government. Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac only have implied moral backing. Sallie Mae went private and has none.
Number three, the phantom income menace. Both TIPS and STRIPS generate taxable phantom income every year based on accrual accounting. Therefore, they should almost always be placed in a tax-deferred account like an IRA.
Number four, CMO tranche risk. The PAIC tranche is the safest cup in the tower, with dual-sided protection against contraction and extension and the lowest yield. The companion tranche is the trash can at the bottom. It's the riskiest, absorbs all the prepayment variability, and offers the highest yield.
And number five, prepayment risk directions. Falling interest rates lead to a refinancing boom and contraction risk, where you get your money back too early. Rising interest rates lead to a frozen housing market and extension risk, where you get your money back too late.
Boom. If you have those five concepts locked down and you understand the why behind them, you are going to crush Function 3 on the Series 7. But before we sign off, we'd like to leave everyone with a slightly bigger macro thought to chew on.
Yeah.
We've spent this whole deep dive dissecting the plumbing of U.S. debt. We talked about how everything from corporate bonds to CMOs is priced relative to treasuries because they have zero default risk. But what if that assumption ever changes?
It is a fascinating and terrifying macro question. Hmm. The entire global financial system treats U.S. treasuries as risk-free. It is the mathematical anchor for literally trillions of dollars in derivatives, mortgages, and corporate debt.
Right.
What happens to the global pricing of risk if the assumption of zero default risk is ever seriously questioned by global markets? What if the anchor moves?
If the anchor moves, every single ship tied to it, from your local bank's mortgage rates to a wildly complex Wall Street CDO, gets violently tossed around. Everything we discussed today is tethered to that one single assumption. Something to mull over while you're grinding through those practice questions.
Definitely.
Remember, understanding the why makes the what so much easier to remember. Go crush the Series 7, and we'll catch you on the next deep dive.